Welcome to the B-Side, a podcast by Black sociologists that engages thinkers at the cutting edge of thought on Black culture, politics, history, social life, and much, much more. I'm Leslie Hinkson from Georgetown University.
And I'm Corey Fields, also from Georgetown University.
So as the name suggests, each week we feature one of our favorite, well, at this point, one of my favorite B-side.
Come on, Leslie. I like them all too. Now I'm feeling bad.
Okay, no, I just didn't want to speak for you, Corey.
No. We speak.
Especially since last week we did have Vanilla Ice.
That is so true. But despite Vanilla Ice, we speak in one voice here on the B-side.
Oh, I love you. Okay, so this week, our B-side track is I Will Survive, released in 1978 by Gloria Gaynor.
I feel like you are really raising the bar with these B-sides because every one of them, I'm like, wait, that wasn't the hit? Come on.
Does anybody know what could possibly have been the A-side for this anthem?
Oh, yeah. No one's gonna get it. I'm assuming it's not your favorite karaoke jam.
No, it's a little ditty called Substitute, right? Which in some ways is kind of like the opposite of I Will Survive, because the lyrics are basically a woman singing to someone about being willing to be the object of her affection substitute, right? For the woman he or she is pining for, right? So does not sound like strength. Does not sound, no.
Although I do have like a weird affinity for like these sort of narrative based songs that kind of take the position of like, yeah, I'll go in a direction you weren't expecting. So I don't know. I might be in the Substitute. I can't wait till the end of the show so I can hear it. Maybe I found my new karaoke.
maybe. Wow. On to our guests.
Yes.
Joining us this week are Patricia Banks from Mount Holyoke College and Michael Jeffries from Wellesley College. So Patricia A. Banks is a sociologist whose research program lies at the intersection of culture, patronage, and markets. Patricia will be at Stanford University as a fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences in 2018 and 2019. And so with her focus on the African diaspora, Patricia Banks studies the determinants, consequences, and meanings of cultural patronage and the processes underlying the emergence and growth of cultural markets. Her most recent work is Represent, Art and Identity Among the Black Upper Middle Class, out from Rutledge. Welcome, Patricia.
Well, thank you so much, Leslie and Corey. I'm just delighted to be here on the B-side.
Oh, okay. We're
I'm
glad
a fan
we could
of the program.
I'll have to pass you some notes on fun things to do in Palo Alto when you're at the center. On the back of the note,
I'll give you
the list
absolutely.
Of like the 10 black people on campus. So.
Okay, so I'll be the 11th.
We laugh, but okay. Michael P. Jeffries teaches courses on American popular culture and the politics of race, class, and gender, and is the author of 3 books, most recently Behind the Laughs, Community and Inequality in Comedy, out from Stanford University Press. His 2 previous books are Paint the White House Black, Barack Obama and the Meaning of Race in America, also from Stanford University Press, and Thug Life, Race, Gender, and the Meaning of Hip Hop from the University of Chicago Press. He's published over 30 essays and works of criticism in the New York Times, The Guardian, The Atlantic, and the Boston Globe, and is a regular contributor on both television and radio at Boston's public broadcasting station, WGBH. And I know this for a fact because I often hear him on selected NPR programs. So welcome to you as well, Michael.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me, guys.
Wow, thanks for being here. We're like classing up the joint with like professional commentary today.
Yeah, I know. So welcome to you both. As we like to do, Corey and I want you to let the listeners know what you're up to these days. And so, Patricia, would you like to start?
Sure. So one strand of my research looks at the patronage of Black culture. And whereas research on art patronage typically focuses on social class, and in particular, how social class influences and is influenced by art patronage, for example, how it's a practice that the upper middle class and upper class use to display their class status, my research explores how other social categories, such as race, are linked to art patronage. In my book, Represent Art and Identity Among the Black Upper Middle Class, I draw on in-depth interviews with over 100 upper middle class Blacks in New York and Atlanta to examine how they use Black cultural objects, the objects that they display in their homes, such as paintings that depict Black people, to construct their racial identity. And while class certainly matters for their art patronage, for example, discretionary income enables them to purchase African-American art, Represent shows that one function of the objects that they collect is to articulate and nurture their own as well as their children's racial identity. Now, if you want to imagine what this looks like to a certain degree, I want you to think about the hit television show Empire. Mm-hmm. There you have a wealthy Black family who has the means to purchase fine art, and the art that they choose to display on their walls is by Black artists and depicts Black people, such as portraits by contemporary artists like Kehinde Wiley and Toyin Oji Odutola. So that was my first major project. It focused on art collecting. And now I'm currently working on a project that looks at philanthropy at African American museums. I think that most people are now familiar with the National Museum of African American History and Culture, which opened in September 2016. But what people may not know is that the National Museum is not alone. It is, in fact, one of around 300 other Black museums and related institutions in the United States. In fact, there is a Black museum in practically every major city in the United States. Of course, we wouldn't have any of these museums without patrons. So the people who donate the money, sit on the boards, and support them in other ways. And while patrons are so important for the Black museum renaissance, we know very little about why people support them. So I set out to find out why by traveling across the country and doing in-depth interviews with patrons. So I'm examining how they think about the value of Black museums and how this varies based on their race, profession, generation, and lifestyle. So for example, with respect to generation, I find that younger supporters or those who are born after 1965 place more emphasis on the importance of contemporary culture and contemporary political movements being featured in Black museums. Now, in a related project, I'm looking at the corporate side of supporting Black culture. For Black cultural institutions, such as the National Museum of African American History and Culture and the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater, a significant source of their funding comes from corporations. So, for example, with the National Museum, there were several corporations that gave seven-figure donations. And while it's very clear what the benefits are of this funding to Black cultural institutions, what is less clear is why corporations give. So through ethnographic and archival research, I'm looking at why they give. And what I'm finding is that Black cultural patronage plays an important role in the broader diversity management of corporations. For example, $1 million donation to a Black cultural institution helps to signal that a corporation values inclusivity. So Black cultural patronage has a very important reputational benefit for corporations.
Yeah, I guess Starbucks is going to be jumping on that bandwagon.
Well, you know, it's amazing because there are so many companies where we're seeing these, racial incidents that are really causing a great deal of controversy. So Starbucks is just one of them.
I mean, it's interesting because it seems like on some level, from the corporation's aspect of this, right, like to get involved in this sort of requires an initial presence of someone who can even direct the company to do it, right? So I wonder if it's the case that corporations that have some internal input pushing towards like inclusion stuff and signaling of diversity are the ones that are going to be sort of most likely to jump on it, right? So it seems like it would already require somebody in-house saying, we should support these museums because it'll make us look good. Before you could even have that there, right? Like, how would they even come up with it without that?
Yes, I think it's interesting. I mean, what you find in some cases, what we're seeing with some of these corporations is that, you know, an incident occurs, then there is this public controversy. And then what happens is they will hire somebody to deal with diversity in the company. And then following, you start to see behaviors such as, you know, supporting the Black cultural sector. And so you're absolutely correct that you have to have somebody within the company to be aware and be concerned with it. But sometimes the way it works is you have the incident and then they hire that person.
So Patricia, a question that I do have has to do, you were talking about how, you know, if you think about people on the boards, for example, and how their gender, their age, their generation, et cetera, actually, you know, seems to influence what they'd like to see in these spaces. I'm wondering whether or not you're seeing, you know, sort of the effects of the age of the institution itself, right? So are some of these institutions just so old and seen as such a legacy that it's sort of like, okay, our job as, you know, as being on the board or as people who are giving is less about trying to sort of inform the mission and more about just giving to help maintain it, whereas maybe newer institutions, you know, sort of people might feel like there's more room or more latitude for them to sort of steer the ship, if you will.
That's a good question. So you're kind of asking if there are kind of organizational effects. So how people of different generations respond to Black museums varies by generation. So Leslie, the really interesting thing about Black museums is they're, as an institutional category, they're very, very new. And so before the 1960s, we had very few African-American museums. Starting in the 1960s and 1970s, we had the Black Museum Movement. And so as part of the broader efforts to establish racial equality in these periods, you start seeing Black museums founded. And then you've just seen this increase over the decades. And so as there aren't that many that are really old, when we start to think about majority institutions, such as the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, you know, they're starting in the 19th century. So they're much older. So just as a class of museums, they're much younger.
So one thing I was wondering as you were talking about this, like, is to what extent do these museums become a platform for like debate and contention and maybe even like fighting, disagreement, generational disagreement or gender disagreement over sort of what it means to be Black or what Blackness represents? Because I'm guessing on some level, in many communities, this museum will serve as, you know, sort of like a statement of what's important in terms of Black art or Black history, right? Which is itself this like contested thing or multivocal thing at a minimum. So I wonder to what extent are these like the things you're witnessing in terms of like internal debates around museum leadership serve as proxies for like debates around what it means to be Black or what we want to represent Blackness.
Absolutely. And I think that, so your question raises an important issue that I'm raising in my book, which is oftentimes when we think about African-American museums, they get contrasted with majority institutions. And so the idea is what is distinctive about them is their Blackness. And you're correct. One of the things that we lose by emphasizing Blackness so much is that I think we often think about these museums in a very homogeneous way. And what you see is that there is absolutely different perspectives about what Blackness means and how these museums should narrate Blackness. So for example, generationally, one of the really fascinating things that's taking place is, you know, many African-American museums are not only, they're history and culture museums. So they have historical objects, they have visual culture. So they're very well-rounded institutions. And when it comes to the historical narratives, one of the things that the younger patrons are often very interested in is seeing the very recent political struggles that are taking place be depicted in African American museums, and older patrons being more focused on, you know, civil rights movement of the 1960s and making sure that that is articulated in institutions. So there's absolutely what you see through the lens of these patrons is different perspectives about Black culture and about Black identity.
I think your research sounds amazing. And I actually, I can't wait for this, like these second and third strands of your research to come out. I'm assuming that's a big part of what you'll be doing at Stanford.
That is what I'll be working on. I'll be working on those two projects and just having an opportunity to dig down into them. I think that one of the things that's exciting is I think that, you know, within the United States, at least, the sociology of art hasn't been as central of a focus to our discipline as it has, for example, in Europe. But I think what one of the things that the National Museum of African American History and Culture does is it helps us to see more broadly why it really is important for us to think about these institutions and, you know, study what is their significance for the nation more broadly.
Cool. Okay, so Michael, what about you? I mean, Patricia's obviously up to a lot. What are you up to these days?
I've just been talking more and more recently about the book on comedy that I just finished, and Patricia's work sounds incredible, and I think it's nice to be on the podcast with another sort of cultural sociologist or sociologist who studies culture or whatever we want to call ourselves.
I know.
Try to keep all the bases covered. But the thing about studying comedy, right, is that it's a popular art form. So it doesn't really get a lot of respect in terms of people who study high culture. But then if you think about the importance of comedy today, not only as a source of entertainment and a creative outlet for people, but as a source of news, right? I mean, that was the big thing that really got me interested in it, was that we know that more and more young people from our generation, perhaps a bit younger, are actually getting their news about the world from comedy. And that just struck me as a tremendously important thing to investigate because nobody had really done it systematically. So I started out wanting to write this book about comedy and politics and political comedy. And the more I sort of dug into that area, you know, I realized that I didn't want to be explaining jokes to people when I was writing the book. It's a recipe for disaster. So I didn't want to write that book. And then I thought, well, I was going to go out and just talk to comedians, whether they were political comedians or they weren't political comedians. I was going to talk to comedians about race, class, and gender, and see how they navigated those things. And that was actually a little bit more interesting in the beginning because you learn all these different life histories and you realize how many different paths there are into the business. But I still found myself asking them too many questions about content. And the more I asked them questions about content, the less interested I was in writing a book that was about jokes and about content. So what the book actually does after those missteps that I made is it talks about comedy as labor. What is it like to actually work in the comedy business? So we have a couple of accounts of this from popular press where they go out and interview a whole bunch of famous people. Like they interview Chris Rock and they print the whole interview. And then they interview Ellen DeGeneres and they print the whole interview. But there's not really a great treatment either in popular press or certainly among academic press that looks at comedians who are professional comedians but are not famous celebrities. Mm-hmm. And talks about what their work lives are like. And in looking at their work lives, you can learn some really interesting things about the comedy business and the entertainment business and about cultural industries more generally. And the place that I start and the kind of the main argument of the book right from the outset is there's a kind of psychological wage that comedians are paid by virtue of belonging to a comic community. And that psychological wage makes up in their minds for all of the lost wages because they work in such an exploitative business, especially for early career comedians and comedians who are trying to make a name for themselves. So they take on that exploitation, but what they get back is the sense of belonging to a comedy community. And then once I've kind of established that there's this comedy community, I can look at the fissures in the community along lines of class, race, and gender. And that's where I think the most important findings of the book ultimately lie. I establish the importance of the comedy community, and then I look at the fissures of that community in comedy's work.
It's interesting. I don't know. This probably won't seem random to you because I'm guessing you thought about it. But as you were talking, I couldn't help but think a little bit about Michael Burrovoy's Manufacturing Consent, right? So I was thinking about like this idea of people working in this exploitative context and the work that they do to sort of get through that or sort of resolve it. And it's interesting to think about this in terms of comedy, right? Like, I guess one of the ways you can put up with the crappy conditions is to be like, oh, but it's an awesome community, right? And that the gatekeepers, right? I guess, I don't know, the employers in some ways, like it's in their interest to keep the community awesome. So it's also, it's interesting to think about the work of the comedians, but also how the situation of the comedians actually affects what the gatekeepers that, you know, of comedy have to do, like the club owners and whatnot. So it's like, they need to be working to generate this sense of community as well, because it behooves them as much as it, you know, does the comedians.
Yeah, and some club owners and club bookers actually work really hard on exactly that, Corey. You know, I mean, I think there's a real divide in comedy communities and the comedy business between people on the business side who are in it because they love comedy and people on the business side who are in it because it's their business and they make a buck.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, there are some people who are running comedy clubs who are only interested in the drinks they sell. They don't really care about the content that they're putting on stage or developing people's careers. But there are just as many people, and it tends to be bookers and managers at smaller clubs in major cities who have been at it for a long time, who really see their role as someone who is developing young comedians professionally and thus kind of preserving the vocation, right? Because there are no, you know, now there are training schools like Upright Citizen Brigade and Second City in Chicago. But for stand-up, there wasn't really an equivalent for stand-up as a training ground, right? Like, you didn't go to stand-up comedy school as a stand-up comic coming up in the 70s. So where do you learn these things? You learn them from informal mentors, your mentors in the business who are artists. And if you're lucky, you might have one or two bookers or club owners along the way who will tell you something and help you learn the ropes of the business as a very early career comic so that you can make it in the long run.
So I don't know if you know, Michael, but I also co-host another podcast called The Annex. And on one of our episodes, our guest was Pat Riley, who also writes about comedy. And in thinking about, like, I'm probably butchering this because it's my memory and I don't know.
It's been a long week.
It's only Tuesday. But if I remember correctly, like, in thinking about the ways in which Pat Riley talked about this comedy club and the business, it was, I thought less about Manufacturing Consent, and it could also be because it was this specific comedy club, and more about like fraternities, right? For example, and you know, in how sort of the worse you're hazed, like the more you believe that your fraternity is like the best in the world, right? So to what extent is there, is part of kind of what creates this feeling of community and fellowship, to what extent is it predicated on extremes of exploitation and suffering?
I think that's a big part of it, honestly. I didn't hear as much about early career comedians being just blatantly mistreated by people at a different career stage. But there's no question that suffering through the hard times becomes a badge of honor for people who are able to stick it out. I think one of the things that makes comedy different from other businesses or from fraternity culture, maybe there's some similarities in fraternity culture, but you know, part of the stickiness, the glue of comedy communities is driven by the fact that this is a job where what you're doing is you're pursuing pleasure. Like you're trying to cause a chemical reaction that makes people feel good all the time. Like when you're on stage, you're trying to make people laugh. Why? Because it helps them feel good to laugh. When you're hanging out off stage in the green room with comics before you go on or after you go on, even in those more relaxed spaces, the banter among comedians is usually directed toward making each other laugh. Like that is the kind of substance of that stickiness. So I think that pursuit of pleasure actually adds another dimension. Like they're not pursuing beauty or like expertise or some sort of some other kind of more abstract notion of value. They're pursuing a very bodily value, right? Making you feel good through laughter. That's a lot of the value that they attribute to their work as well.
Now, do comedians talk about their work in such sort of other directed, selfless terms? It's like, it makes it sound like, oh, right, they're just thinking about you as the audience. Like, that's the sort of motivation and driver. Because I wonder, is there a parallel, like, internal motivation of, like, it makes me feel good to be on stage and be getting attention or like controlling the pleasure of someone else. I mean, I feel like in some ways that maybe it's interesting. Actually, I'm taken with this idea because I feel like to the extent that we get a narrative into the backstage of comedy through films and TV and interviews and stuff, you often get this sense of the selfish motivations of comedy, right? Like it's sort of, you want attention, you want to make people laugh. It's like you focused. Whereas what you're saying is like, there's actually a great deal of audience focus, like, you know, the motivation being other driven.
Yeah. I mean, so that's one of the things I found myself writing against in the book, right? So there's no question, we can start there. Like there's no question that many performers, comedic performers and comedy workers are narcissists. Like But the more extreme version of that narrative about narcissism is that the whole reason they got up on stage is because they're not well adjusted socially. Like they have some kind of deficit that they're trying to make up for and compensate for by getting on stage. Right? Like they need the love they didn't get as a child. So from the audience, right? That's like they go up there and they try to compensate for things they didn't get, or they're really depressed. And when they go on stage, that's the only time they're happy. And that's why when they leave the stage, they abuse drugs and they become alcoholics and all these other kind of stories about famous comics who lived fast and died too young, right? And I think that's just, in my experience, that was not at all a fair characterization of who comedy workers are. The idea that comedy workers are socially inept, to me, and according to my findings, is that it's simply untrue. In order to make it in the business, you have to be really socially dexterous. You have to be able to navigate all kinds of relationships with your manager, with your agent, with the audience, with other people who are working in comedy, the people who go on stage before you and after you. And if you can't make it navigating those relationships, there's no way you're going to have a long career. So this idea that the people who have long careers in comedy are the people who are most messed up in the head, like that's just not true. Or people who make it the longest in comedy are the people who can only survive on stage. Like that's not true at all. You have to be able to survive on stage, off stage, and really thrive in social circumstances.
Yeah, I love the angle, like treating, like, yeah, thinking about it as work and as like a career and as the, you know, the sort of the organizational field of comedy. It definitely, I mean, and hearing you talk about it, I'm thinking about what Lauren Rivera's stuff on Cultural Fit, Koji Chavez's stuff on tech companies. Like, it's interesting to think about comedy as just a, you know, as an illustration of sort of work processes and play. That's very cool.
Yeah, yeah, I had a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun with it for sure.
Yeah, well, speaking of comedy, Michael, I think that, you know, as we do on this show, we like to talk about things that have been in the news over the past week. And I think the biggest comedy show over the past week was just the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Corey, do you want to take the lead on our banter?
I'm not sure there's much of a lead to take. I'm just very curious to hear what you guys are thinking about it, right? So, I mean, yeah, this is always this interesting dynamic of surely this story must be as big as I think it is. There's no need to give any backdrop to it. But we're right. We're all in our own bubbles. And actually, I think this story is a perfect illustration of bubbles. So, right. The White House Correspondents' Dinner was this past weekend, as we're taping this past weekend. And the comic performance of Michelle Wolf has been polarizing. I guess we can put it that way, right? So I don't know, as I thought what generally happens at one of these sort of internal in-group roast things, right? Like she made fun of the attendees, which included, you know, the press that covers the White House. It included the people who work in the White House, including Sarah Huckabee Sanders. But it did not go down well with many members of the press. Yeah, so there's been, you know, some pushback suggesting that it was too mean. There have been claims that, you know, she attacked Sarah Sanders' appearance, which I guess is supposed to invoke concerns about body shaming and whatnot. That's all wasn't particularly clear to me, because I have to admit, as a non-Washington insider and, you know, not a big comedy insider, I kind of didn't get the fuss. I got that there was a fuss. I'm still trying to source through what I think about it. So how about you all tell me what you think about it?
Well, just in terms of body shaming, I mean, that wasn't really body shaming. I mean, it was like, it was about her makeup, right? That's not about body. That's about taste. Number one, I mean, if you think about years previous, like no one talked about body shaming when people like talked about Donald Trump's hair. Right? Or his complexion. So I don't know. I find that I think was like kind of like a bridge too far. I was taking it a little too far. I think that she was crass. And I think that people tend to react differently when a man is crass and when a woman is crass. I think that's part of it. And I think the other thing is, I think that she held women to task. Right? Sort of being like, you're not really down for the cause, and I am totally gonna shout you out. Those of you out here, or who should be out here, who I think we should note are not really down for other women.
I mean, the gender angle on it is one. I mean, I've heard, yeah, some people talk about that. I mean, obviously the angle of, you know, the Huckabee Sanders stuff, but also the calling out of women. But it seems like, and that the Michelle Wolf being crass, but like no one would care if she was a guy. But it seems like every year there's some version of this kerfuffle. Like no matter if the comedian's a dude or a woman, because like when Colbert did it a few years ago, there's just, you know, it just seems, I guess I don't really understand. Like, is this performative outrage afterwards part of the process? I don't know. What do you guys think, Patricia and Michael?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to say about it is, in the context of comedy, there was nothing extraordinary about what Wolf did. And I don't mean to say that as a slight to Wolf, or as a comment on whether or not she was funny, or as a comment on her skills. She's a professional comedian. I think she did what professional comedians do. So it's bizarre, truly bizarre, that they would invite a comedian to do a roast and then get mad when the comedian did a roast. It baffles the mind, honestly. So that's one piece of it. Then with respect to, okay, like if that's not it, right? If it's not the comedy that was out of the ordinary, what then was out of the ordinary? And I think there were a couple of things, right? One is the president wasn't there. So Sanders sat in the president's seat and was sort of appearing as a stand-in for the Trump White House. So in that respect, she became a much more significant target than the press secretary usually is, right? That's one piece of this. The second piece of this is all of this is occurring in a context where the White House has repeatedly attacked the credibility of the media, right? That is something that is unique, at least with respect to the degree of the attacks to the White House correspondent. It's never been held within this sort of atmosphere around media, right?
But what's interesting is that Wolf also attacked the credibility of the media, right?
That's exactly where I'm going. That's exactly where I'm going, right? So having already set the temperature, right, the White House is the entity that set the temperature for attacking the media. So it can't then just be the fact that Wolf attacked the media, right? Because the White House has already attacked the media. That can't possibly be the offense. It must then be about content, not about decorum, right? Not about whether or not she was too mean, not even about whether it was about appearance or whether it was about taste. It must be about the content of the jokes. And when all you're doing is critiquing the content of the jokes, then what you're doing is really raising questions about free speech and whether or not the invested in protecting free speech at all costs. And that I think is what we should be troubled by, that this group that depends upon, right, that amendment for its relevance was unable seemingly to get past some of its own interests and its own vanity in the way they treated Wolf after the fact. It's not a surprise that people on the right objected to Wolf's routine, but I found it surprising that the press objected the way they did.
Right, because I guess we should say the White House Correspondents Association gave what amounted to an apology, right? Like for the performance, sort of saying, you know, our goal was to come together and celebrate the First Amendment and blah, blah, blah. And it's unfortunate that Wolf didn't live up to that, you know, standard or something. Yeah, no, it's crazy because in some ways it does, I don't know. I don't want to get too deep and existential here on the B side, but it made me really sad because in some ways it felt like this just feels like it's actually eroding my confidence in the media. And I've been all like, we shouldn't be working to erode the confidence in the media. Stop saying fake news, blah, 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 blah. But after this, it feels a little bit like you played yourself, media, like a lot. And, it's kind of striking because in some ways it is essentially confirming the very things Wolf was saying, I feel like. You know, she's sort of saying like, look, this whole thing feels like a sham. They lie to us and you sit right there and know that they're lying and then write it down and spill it back to the American public. And they get it up in a huff. And then the response is to be like, to do something that so clearly illustrates that this organization can't be taken seriously as a defender of truth and the First Amendment just really does seem to confirm the very thing she was critiquing in her comedy routine.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that she does bring up in her comedy routine is Donald Trump and his alleged racism. And I say alleged, you know, I obviously have my opinions on whether or not Donald Trump is or is not racist or racial, as Omarosa would say. But that's neither here nor there. I mean, she does definitely bring up white supremacy quite a few times. And that, I think, actually, that in many ways, I think, is evocative to me and reminds me of the fact that, you know, that we have this new monument that was unveiled this week, the unveiling of the lynching memorial in Montgomery, Alabama, Corey.
Holy transitions, Batman. Yes.
I tried.
I figured that was going to be a tough one.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah. So, no. The lynching memorial, right, which, yeah, was another big news story this week. And, yeah, I mean, I do feel like it's really very great timing with our guest this week, because I would love to hear both Patricia and Michael, your thoughts on this. Patricia, I mean, how is this something that you had been on your radar as a result of your research on African American museums?
Absolutely. In fact, I was supposed to go to the opening, but I wasn't able to. So it absolutely has been on my radar, and it's incredibly significant. And I think one of the important things to remember is that it's not only that there is a new memorial, but there's also a new museum. And mm-hmm. so it's the Legacy Museum. And this museum explores slavery and mass incarceration. And so the museum is really part of this broader Black museum boom that we're seeing. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the International African American Museum, where they're fundraising for that in Charleston, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. There's also fundraising for the Jackie Robinson Museum in New York, two hip-hop museums in New York. And then you have museums like the Studio Museum in Harlem and the Motown Museum in Detroit that are getting new homes. So right now, millions of dollars are being raised for Black museums. So we are in this period where you have donors who are interested in funding these institutions. And I find it very fascinating when we start to think about the Black middle class and the Black upper class more broadly. While there isn't a whole lot of specific data on who is supporting these institutions, the available evidence suggests that for Black museums, they are more dependent on African Americans than majority institutions. So, for example, they're more likely to have a larger proportion of Black trustees, and they're more likely to get their funding from African Americans. And so it's really interesting to think about what the implications are for growth in the Black upper middle and upper class, and the degree to which the Black cultural sector is dependent on this community.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, what's interesting about like this museum is it has the potential, I think, to serve as a nice sort of linkage between like some of the very factions you were talking about earlier, Patricia, right? Like sort of people who want to talk about sort of 1960s era civil rights stuff or sort of Black history, right? And memorializing that. And younger folks who want to talk about sort of current social policy, current conditions for African Americans, right? And what's the Lynching Museum, I think, is a part of it, right? Is linking sort of this narrative of, creating this through line between, you know, public lynchings and current police brutality, right? And I was, actually, the time it is, because I was teaching Ida B. Wells in my social theory undergrad class this past week. And one of the things we talked about was, you know, thinking about lynching as part of the story of lynching is denial of Black humanity, right? Both at an individual level, but also within the legal system. And that the current, you know, police brutality, criminal justice, corruption notions, right, similarly revolve around a denial of sort of full inclusion into the legal system for Black people. And so it's interesting to think about the museum itself bridging some of the divides that we talk about within the Black generational divide within the Black community, where it's like, you know, older Black people or maybe sort of more affluent Black people are kind of wanting to talk about overcoming things in the past, and you have younger people and people in sort of, you know, urban communities that are dealing with this police violence, wanting to talk about problems of today. And it seems like the museum is trying to thread the needle between those two. That seems cool.
Absolutely. And so there's the memorial. So there's the memorial, and then there's also the museum. So there's two. There are two developments here. And you're absolutely correct. It's making this link. It's making this link between the, you know, historical inequalities that we see with mass incarceration today to the legacy of slavery. And, you know, museums and monuments are so important because they have the power to legitimate particular narratives of the past. And so what we see with the memorial and what we see with the museum is that the history of lynching is being positioned as an important part of our history here in the United States. So it's a very important development.
Yeah, when I heard about the original plans for the monument to be built, it reminded me of when I was an undergrad, and I remember it was my first year, and the museum had a lynching exhibit or photographs of lynchings, and there was a huge, there's a huge brouhaha that ensued among alumni, trustees, even current students who were just like, you know what, this is not good. These need to be taken down. But I remember, like, as a first year student, I mean, I think, you know, this was the first time I'd seen these images up close. I mean, I'd seen them on PBS specials. And the thing that struck me the most about these images wasn't about the bodies that, you know, that had been desecrated, because that was the main complaint usually of the people who wanted them taken down. What was of particular interest to me were the people who were part of the spectacle, right? And I think that was the first time that I really understood that, you know, there is this other function of lynchings, which is, I mean, there's this form of social control, not just of the objects of the lynching, but the people who were there to witness it. It's like, you will see this and you will be part of this, right? And this is one of the ways in which you get socialized into mm-hmm. the racial hierarchy. That's number one. And also number two, it's also a way of creating community, right? It's almost like, you know, if you think about a ritual sacrifice, right? In other societies, whether it's of a pig or a goat or of another human being, right? You know, this is a sacrament that's actually meant to sort of solidify this sense of community. And in that respect, I think that's another really important function of having a monument, is understanding the ways in which whiteness and white society in the U.S., you know, post Reconstruction, you know, actually kind of relied on this kind of extreme violence.
Right. It's also, I think this also relates to Patricia's work, right? Because there's this tension where, on the one hand, you know, with like Black museums, you feel like, yeah, this is our stuff and like our museum, and it's like, you know, a pathway to celebrate and discuss our history and also our future and who we are and what we're about, right? But at the same time, the point Leslie just made of like, this isn't just Black people stuff, you know, like this is all of our stuff. And so, you know, I think, you know, I'm excited to read Patricia's book, because I feel like in some ways, I imagine this has to be a similar tension that exists in museuming overall, right? Black museuming anyway, of like, to what extent do you say this is a Black thing versus this is a everybody thing? And I guess that latter orientation, you know, might actually cast the net wider of who you can get to support the institution, but also sort of shifts the landscape of what gets talked about within it. But I agree with you, Leslie, that yes, it's one of the, I think, important and in some ways under-discussed points of the memorial and the museum, is to, you know, think about not just, you know, lynching as an experience, it's something that Black people experienced, but also to flip, to invert that and think about the flip side of that.
Stevenson is explicit about that, right? Like, he's never, to my knowledge, he's never really spent a lot of capital framing this as a museum for Black people.
Right.
Every time I've heard him speak about it, it's about getting the entire country to face mm-hmm. this history in a new way. So he's been quite honest that that's part of his, motivation for building the monument and the museum. And the other piece of this is, like, he wants it to be a visceral and intimate experience. This is not something where you just go in and look and don't actually feel anything. The only way to understand the depth and the power of the terrorism is to go and sit in the space and to have a relationship with the space and the visual power of the monument itself. And that visual power is essential to the project of lynching, right? Like, the public visibility that you all have just discussed, like, you can't understand the purpose of the terrorism without reckoning with that kind of visibility. And Stevenson's always been forthright about that. He said, we haven't reckoned with this yet as a country. So you have to come here and feel this if you want to know what terrorism was actually about.
Well,
I know.
Finally segueing from Black suffering to Black joy.
Yay. And something else that I think would qualify as it really helps to be there to feel it viscerally in person.
Yeah. And also on the theme of culture and the production of culture and also museums. Has anyone had a chance to see the Obama portraits hanging in the National Portrait Gallery?
I did. I had family in town and, like, a dutiful Black son. I took my mama to see the Obama portraits. and a good Black uncle. I took my niece and nephew. I'm going to bring them up, right? I saw them. And it was actually really, really cool. I mean, I'm a big fan of both artists. So, yes. You know, and I had seen pictures online. And so I wasn't, you know, I was sort of had some sense of what I was getting into. But what I really enjoyed, particularly with, like, Obama's portrait, was the juxtaposition, right, in the gallery of all the other presidents. Mm-hmm. You really do feel this sense of, I don't know, both ease and difference in the Obama portrait. I don't know, there was something about it that I liked, that there is, like, a casualness about it, but still, like, a statement being made. And I think similarly, the Michelle Obama portrait, that was just also, I don't know, in some ways, like, viscerally stunning and kind of a much more stop you in your tracks kind of experience. And I felt like even the surrounding crowds, because it was still, you know, it was pretty crowded. And it was just really amazing to see people engaging with art, actually, like, beyond the portraits themselves. But so, yeah, so I've seen them. I don't know. Anybody else?
No, I can't wait to see them. But I think your reaction sounds like it's similar to so many other people's, because what they're saying is that Michelle Obama's portrait is the most popular portrait of a first lady. So
it is.
No, and I can see why. I mean, there was, you know, a queue to take pictures with mm-hmm. it, right? And it was like, oh, wow. And so, you know, you had to, like, wait for a moment to jump in and just sort of take it in. I mean, it was also mm-hmm. this sort of weird moment of, like, seeing people experience things. Like, I felt super old because I was trying to explain to my little nephew who was 8. I was like, how about you look at the photo first and then take a picture of it with your camera? And he was just sort of bewildered, like, what? But there were so many people, like, experiencing it through, like, camera phones. It was kind of crazy. But anyway, that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the portraits, and, you know, yeah, I mean, I agree with what Corey said. You know, I think part of the reason why Michelle Obama's portrait is currently the most popular of the portraits of first ladies is because it's new. Right. But I think it is also an incredibly visually arresting portrait. I thought it was beautifully, beautifully, beautifully done. And I think that, I mean, I kind of felt like there was, like, I don't, this real chemistry between artist and subject, right? That I didn't necessarily feel with a lot of the other first ladies. And I don't know if it's because I'm sure all of the first ladies, played a huge role in mm-hmm. selecting, the artist who was going to represent them. I don't know why it is. I felt that chemistry with her more than I think almost any of the other first lady portraits.
Well, you wonder if it doesn't have something to do with the kind of broader project that they were engaged in. When they asked Kehinde Wiley and Cheryl to do their portraits, they were asking artists to do them who are African-American, and there have been no other African-American artists who have painted portraits. And so mm-hmm. they were involved in this practice of patronage that had tremendous significance. And so you wonder if maybe that is part of it.
Huh. Well, I mean, so I think one of the things is I would say I even kind of felt a contrast. Like I kind of felt like there was even more chemistry between the artist and subject in Michelle Obama's portrait than in Barack Obama's portrait.
That's interesting. I mean, I wonder if part of that is like the constraints of the genre, right? Mm-hmm. So I feel like the presidential portrait, I mean, certainly when you see it amongst all the other presidential portraits, you do get a sense of the sort of genre requirements, right? And that like how they can be constraining, even though the Obama portrait feels like not a lot of other stuff in that section. Though, parenthetically, there are a couple of very cool non-traditional presidential portraits mm-hmm. worth seeing. But it seems like, I wondered if that somehow affected both, you know, your response to it, but also the painting itself, right? Because it actually, for as different as it is, it still gives you this same air of a presidential portrait, right? And so it's not mm-hmm. like loose and devil may care or like, you know, balls to the wall kind of. But I think that's partly like, could it have been, right? I don't know.
So could Kehinde Wiley have painted a portrait that had that intimacy, even if it had
right,
been Michelle Obama?
Right, right. Or, I mean, well, I guess that's an interesting, I hadn't thought of it. I guess I was thinking more of like, is it the requirements of a presidential portrait period, right? That somehow...
I see. So even if Amy Sherald had done the
exactly.
portrait, it would have had more distance.
Right. Huh?
It's very interesting.
Yeah. Oh God, we could do this all day, but
yeah, totally. I'm looking at the time,
I know, because I got like 20 comedy shows I want to talk about with Michael. So,
yeah, no, sadly, our time has come to an end. Corey and I really want to thank the two of you, our guests, Patricia Banks of Mount Holyoke College and Michael Jeffries from Wellesley College, for what I thought was a really great conversation today.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, guys.
Yeah, thank you. And we'd also like to thank our young producers out of Queens College, Anika Chowdhury and Joshua Rivera, for all they do. And our newer, even younger producers, Vashti Williams of Georgetown University and the baby of the family, Dana Hinkson from Hill Friedman World Academy High School in Philadelphia. You can find the B-side along with her sister programs at sociocast.org. You can tweet Corey at
B-side_podcast. And they're tweeting us, Leslie. We operate as one when we speak in the B-side voice.
Yeah,
you're not tweeting me.
But I don't have the app. So
oh, you didn't get? I printed them out. I left them in your box. Okay, fine. No.
You did? Oh, I know how you hate paper. I know that wasn't true.
But yeah, at @B-side_podcast to communicate with the podcast. Let us know what you think. If there's anything you want to hear about,
give us your B-side track recommendations
and B-side track recommendations.
Okay. And speaking of which, taking us out today is here's that A-side track to I Will Survive, Substitute. So hope to speak to you next week.
All right. Have a good one, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.